An expansion by Boeing will bring a couple dozen new jobs to Helena. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Connor Valentine, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capital reporter Dan Boyce has today's action from the Economic Summit in Butte. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry looks at why Whitefish has been named an e-city by Google. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with an expert on sustainable land management. Boeing says it is expanding its Helena manufacturing plant by almost 50%. The $35 million expansion will add between 20 and 25 jobs to the facility's workforce. It will allow for the building of parts for the company's 787 Dreamliner. Boeing CEO Jim McNerney announced the expansion at the Montana Economic Development Summit in Butte alongside Senator Max Baucus and Governor Steve Bullock. McNerney says the facility will be making a very important part for the Dreamliner.
And it's the part that joins the body to the wing. That can't fail, okay?
Boeing touts the Dreamliner as a lighter, more fuel-efficient, and more modern airplane. The plane has been making headlines after airlines experienced problems with its lithium-ion batteries catching fire. McNerney says these are serious problems and the company is addressing them. But he says Boeing completely believes in the Dreamliner and customers and investors are enjoying that too.
We have an order book for the 787. It's the biggest order book in the history of aviation. So our customers are probably a truer test of faith in the airplane than I would be.
McNerney says the company has been impressed by the work ethic of their Montana staff.
Our investment in the site's infrastructure, people, and the new products is testament to the Helena team's ability to deliver on their commitments and establish themselves as a reliable, globally competitive supplier to our commercial airplanes program.
Construction will begin at the Helena facility this fall. The expansion should be finished sometime toward the end of 2014. The Montana Job Summit also heard today from the likes of Ford Motor Company CEO Alan Mulally, Hewlett-Packard CEO Meg Whitman, and former ambassador to China and Republican presidential candidate John Hutsman.
And now the shaking of hands and rubbing of elbows is winding down in Butte. The Montana Economic Development Summit wrapped up in the mining city today. Senator Max Baucus's office and the Montana Chamber of Commerce led the organization for the event. Corporate sponsors paid the $250,000 bill for the two-day summit, letting anyone who signed up to come for free. Capital reporter Dan Boyce says about 4,000 total attendees registered to not only hear from some of the world's leading business executives, but also to network.
Are you here to actually participate in
yes,
the session?
Yes, free domain and hosting for you.
Awesome. Yeah, so you can get in the back.
22-year-old Alex Crosby finished up at the MSU College of Business this spring. He's attending a workshop put on at the Economic Development Summit by Google, a workshop helping people get their business online. And the search giant is offering to set these people up with a website free for the first year. Crosby's business is still in the startup phase.
It's a hydroponic heirloom tomato greenhouse.
Basically, he wants to provide fresh produce to Montanans year-round that's grown in the state. And he says he has met people here at the summit that can help him in this plan, such as experts in geothermal heating.
People that can really help us get a competitive advantage over Southern California or our competitors nationwide.
Missoulian Molly Bradford already has her business online. Seeing as it's an online business, she's mingling during a break with an extra bundle of joy.
And I have baby William, who is 3.5 months old, strapped to my chest. He's my CFO.
She provides community events calendar software and runs MissoulaEvents.net and other similar websites. She wasn't sure how this whole job summit was going to unfold, but she says she's been able to make great connections.
The great headliners that are here attracted an unbelievable group of hundreds of people, and they were the magnet to get them here. And then outside of the sessions is when we all hopefully sort of find each other.
It's just relationships. It's getting to know people.
Montana Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Webb Brown says that especially happens in the hallways between official events.
We find that in Montana, it's such a huge state, that there are people who are doing work here that either have a product they can sell or they have material they need. They can get it in Montana, but they just don't know that the people are there that can supply that or buy that on the other side.
Senator Baucus's office has sponsored 6 of these economic development summits. Brown says connections made at previous summits have resulted in big business deals. He points to Seattle-based alloy metal parts manufacturer Seacast building a foundry in Butte, GE starting a call center in Billings with more than 100 employees. He says many more connections are happening on a smaller scale and may not bear any business fruit for months or years.
And it also may be that we never even hear about it. I mean, most folks aren't going to do a press announcement on adding another job. But like I say, that job's important. And if it came out of here, that's a success for us as well.
Molly Bradford has one other full-time employee working for her online business now. She does hope to grow that in the next year. Maybe the Economic Development Summit will help her do that. And maybe having a baby strapped to her chest will help too. Either with old friends just happy to see the little munchkin.
Or with new people who just like babies and then we strike up a conversation.
Sometimes it helps to stand out. I'm Dan Boyce reporting in Butte.
Check out our website to hear full keynote speeches from some of the biggest names at the Jobs Summit, including Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg and Google Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt. It's all at mtpr.org.
And in other news from around the state, Google annually recognizes one city from each state as that state's e-city. An e-city has a strong business presence online with businesses across the community using websites, blogs, and social media to connect with their clients. It's also a community made up of businesses that show a strong likelihood of growth in the digital economy. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more from Montana's e-city, Whitefish.
Montana Coffee Traders has its roastery on Highway 93, just south of downtown Whitefish. Up front is a coffee bar and gift shop. Downtown Whitefish has a Coffee Traders Cafe, as do downtown Columbia Falls and Kalispell. But Coffee Trainer Coordinator Katie Carlson says that's not the only place to buy the Montana roasted coffee.
And I would say travelers come to the Flathead Valley, they experience our stores, coffee, baked goods, merchandise, come to the roastery, have a tour and a tasting, and then head back home. And they're able to connect back with their travel experience in Whitefish through our website.
Customers can order coffee, get a guide to coffee roasting, grinding, and brewing, and find locations at the company's website. Carlson says they now also use social media to keep connected to customers.
It's easier, I think, on our Facebook page to put fresh and new ideas on with what's going on with our company, with new coffee that's coming in, what's going on in our cafes.
President of the Zane Ray Group, Reed Gregerson, counts Patagonia, Land's End, and Filson among his clients.
Basically, our clients look to us to handle some or all aspects of their e-commerce effort.
Gregerson says he's surprised to hear that Whitefish was chosen as Google's e-city for 2013, as opposed to one of the state's larger cities like Missoula or Billings. He says the internet access in the Flathead is pretty good, but the Zane Ray Group also hosts websites. And Gregerson says locally the infrastructure is lacking the redundancy he needs, and they work with a server out of Spokane. However, he says maybe one reason Whitefish was chosen has to do with quality of life.
You know, it's a beautiful place to live, and a lot of the jobs here are possible because of the internet. And yet we're out, you know, we're essentially out here in the middle of nowhere, and yet we're, you know, able to make metropolitan salaries. And, and then at the end of the day, we step out our door and drive down the road 10 minutes and go fly fishing.
Google recognizes an e-city in each state as that state's digital capital. It contracts with the company Ipsos to find these cities. First, Ipsos puts together a list of all U.S. cities, broken down by population size. Google calculates the top five cities for each state using AdWords data. AdWords is Google's main advertising product, where companies use certain keywords and can pay to come up higher in Google's search results. They then looked at a sample of businesses operating in those cities, analyzing web presence, including whether businesses had blogs, offered e-commerce, and maintained a social media presence. Chief Product Officer John Franson of Old Town Creative says he's not so surprised Whitefish won out.
There is a kind of a next generation of business growth in places like Montana, and especially in the places like Montana that have vibrant communities and great landscapes and natural assets, because that's the kind of places where talented people want to live and work.
Franson says Old Town Creative develops internet software focusing on location. They work with organizations and businesses who want an online, interactive map on their page. One client is a non-governmental organization based in Seattle that works to get drinking water to people in need in the developing world.
And so now you have, say, thousands of these locations all across China, India, and Nepal, and someone needs to keep track of those. So they need to manage the information. They need to go and report from the location, get, you know, is the system still operating, take pictures, things like that.
Software developed by Franson's Whitefish Business is what they're using to coordinate that information. Producer Brett Allen runs the Snow Ghost Music Studio out of his Whitefish home. He's worked with local musicians and also with people from all over.
I did a Chris Christopherson recording, Peter Bjorn and John. I did Ramblin' Jack Elliott. He used to pass through here quite a bit. He's a great guy. Death Cab for Cutie.
Allen describes Snow Ghost as an old-school studio with access to the modern world.
You know, we have the ability to propagate the world, like I said, with music through aggregators that they're called aggregators, and they get all the music out to iTunes and Pandora and all that. So, you know, it's like you could record here today and your music could be for sale online by the end of the day.
Allen says he chose Whitefish because it's a place he wanted to be. It allows Snow Ghost to differentiate itself. In the same way Allen says music today is crossing boundaries, running a music production house doesn't have to be in musical city centers like Nashville or New York.
The cool thing about music today is anybody can make it. You know, if you've got 1,000 Facebook friends, you can market, you know, or push your music to them, and you can sell some t-shirts at concerts.
The same idea of being able to make a business work despite geographic barriers seems to be holding true for web design, software development, and coffee roasting in Whitefish, Montana. Other digital capitals chosen by Google include New York City, Park City, Utah, Atlanta, Georgia, Bainbridge Island, Washington, and Fargo, North Dakota. Katrin Fryett reporting from the Flathead.
The first female U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Kathleen Stevens, is in Missoula to speak about diplomacy in East Asia. Stevens first went to South Korea as a Peace Corps volunteer in the 1970s and served as ambassador from 2008 to 2011. She has just retired from 35 years in the Foreign Service. Stevens says the U.S. has no choice but to continue to use diplomacy to deal with the sometimes belligerent regime of North Korea.
I think we have to continue to try to, you know, work with this, what diplomacy is, and work with this, what life is, work with the circumstances we're presented with. And I think what we've tried to do with the new leader of North Korea is to say in a very consistent way, you know, the door is still open, as it's been for some time, to a different future for North Korea when it makes some choices, moving away from pursuing nuclear weapons and missiles that are very ill-spit, among other things, and focusing more on a more sustainable and stable life for its people and for the region.
Ambassador Stevens will speak about diplomacy and leadership in East Asia tonight at 7:30 in the Del Brown Room of Turner Hall of the on the University of Montana campus. We'll have a feature interview with Stevens tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
Solutions from the Land Dialogue Project Coordinator Ernie Shea says land managers are increasingly exploring the potential of using their lands in a more sustainable way. In doing so, Shea says they open up new potential revenue streams. As he puts it, these sustainably minded producers suddenly find themselves in the quality of life business. Solutions from the Land Dialogue is an organization promoting sustainable land management and natural resource enhancement through collaboration. The group is in western Montana this week studying the main successes in the Clark Fork Basin. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Ernie Shea explains new opportunities opening up to the land managers and the new emphasis on collaboration.
They produce food and fiber and fuel, obviously, but they also provide much-needed public benefits that are ecosystem service-type benefits. So when we have crops that are grown with proper conservation systems, maybe cover crops, field buffers, we're producing cleaner water when it flows off the land than otherwise might have occurred. We improve the soil quality and capture greenhouse gas emissions. We sequester carbon into the soil. So we're an enormous solution set for climate change challenges around the country. When we think about endangered species and where these plants and animals reside, many of them reside on America's public lands. Who are the caretakers of public lands? It's farmers, ranchers, and foresters. So we've been having a conversation about not so much the past, but really the future, and talking about how as the world population increases, as the demands increase on the land, we've got to find a way to meet these needs in a sustainable way. And that got us into this idea of landowners, land managers being compensated for a much wider range of goods and services than they have been in the past.
What's the Pathways Project? That sounds like a big piece of this.
It is. This project began 3 years ago with a series of dialogues with several hundred thought leaders from the ag, conservation, forestry communities around the country. And they quickly coalesced around the vision that by the year 2050, land could be managed to meet these major societal needs. And in doing so, create fresh economic opportunities for the land managers themselves. That was the easy part. The hard part came when we said, well, how are we going to deliver on that vision? So we spent the last 3 years working with several hundred of these thought leaders from the ag, forestry, and conservation community and government agency and business partners thinking about what has to change in order to get there. And when we started to look at the challenges that we're going to face, one of the biggest ones being the population is going to go from 7 billion people in the world to 9.5 billion. When we have the realization that our fossil fuel resources are probably at a finite level and we're going to have to find ways to produce more cleaner energy off the land. When we looked at the potential for food and fiber production systems expanding into natural ecosystems to meet that demand for more food and feed to satisfy the growing world population, these all became what we called mega challenges. And we came to the conclusion that relying on the government to bring forward program after program after program to solve these problems and looking to Washington or looking to Helena or looking to a local county government for all the answers was not realistic. That era is gone. We've had 5 or 6 decades worth of public expectation that the government would fix all these things. Well, the government can help. The government can bring some resources to bear, but they're not going to be the solution. So our Pathways report has a chapter on ways to kind of reboot America's private public sector research program around land management so that we can focus on outcomes more than just a bushel of corn or a side of beef. What we're really talking about are managing the land in ways where we're harnessing resources from not just the government agencies, but from NGO partners, from landowners themselves. We're talking about a future where we're going to have markets in place that pay producers for these extra values that they bring forward.
Who pays?
The consumer pays.
Ah.
At a scale, though, that is shared across all of society so that it's a fraction of what it would cost if the costs were borne just by the government. So if you can provide a small incentive in the value of the food or the fiber or the energy commodity, that creates that incentive for the farmer, the forester or land manager, to not just cut down a tree and ship it to market, but to make sure that they are maintaining a sustainable forestry operation that is also managed for wildlife habitat, for clean water, for endangered species protection, for biodiversity.
Do you think the average consumer cares about these things? Somebody goes to a Kroger or a Safeway or whatever their market of choice is. Do they just want a cheap, decent apple?
I think the public is not homogeneous. There's not just one public. And I think if you look at stores like Whole Foods across the country, you've got producers that are producing for a market that is willing to pay a little extra. In that case, it's probably an organic or a lower input. So what we're trying to do is scale this up. if we're unhappy about the way government is performing, if we're unhappy about paying more taxes to deliver these outcomes, you've got to be creative. So what we're thinking long and hard about are some of these market incentives that can spread costs much wider and create an additional incentive that will allow producers to continue to stay in business and maintain economically viable operations that produce these wider range of goods and services. So we're here in the Clark Fork watershed for the next 3 days with a group of about 50 of these thought leaders from ag, forestry, and conservation organizations and agencies across the country. And we're here to take a look at what's been happening over the last 20 years. And this is an example of what we call an area of hopeful progress, where local leaders had a whole series of complicated, high-profile challenges, whether it's water quality challenges in the Clark Fork as a result of the mining waste that have flowed downriver for scores of years, soil health qualities, whether it's wildlife issues, endangered species issues, forest health issues. All of these challenges have manifested themselves in this part of the country.
And do you think people outside of our immediate area are taking note?
They very much are taking note. When we put our Pathways report together, we've had a very difficult time finding a resource base where these types of projects have been researched, documented. We found the Clark Fork, and we found about a dozen others around the country. And the leaders that we're working with at the national level, and they include some international leaders, said they are doing groundbreaking work. They're pioneers. We need to go take a firsthand look at what's different. So that's why we're here for the next 3 days. We have 50 leaders in from across the country, former presidents of national farm organizations, forestry organizations, conservation organizations, government leaders, wildlife experts. It's a very diverse collection. And we're going to be meeting with leaders from the Clark Fork Coalition, the Blackfoot Challenge, the Watershed Restoration Coalition. They're going to tell us how they went about moving from an old way, which was oftentimes characterized by conflict and challenges and managing for single objectives, to a model where they, not that they don't have problems and bad days, obviously they do, but where there's a healthy respect for each of the players that comes to the table, where there's a willingness to listen about the critical need not just to manage for water, but also to manage for an economically viable operation. And we're going to take a look at projects that they've put on the ground and have been tracking for a decade or more. And our hope is that we can leave with lessons learned. And our plan then is to capture these lessons and share them with other innovative leaders all across the country that are trying to do similar work.
Last question, just briefly. In the end, do the ConAgras and Monsantos of the world run the game, control the agenda?
I think at the end of the day, the people that control the agenda are individual landowners who have to wake up every day and maintain an economically viable operation. There are all kinds of production systems in the world. Some are more what perhaps you would consider to be commercial or industrial models, where we're producing very intensely in a landscape. We need those production systems to feed 9.5 billion people, but we don't need them everywhere. We also need smaller scale, diverse farming and ranching and forestry operations that are a different type of agriculture and forestry. So we talk with the industrial stakeholders like those you mentioned. We talk also to the smaller scale family operations. We talk and include in the Solutions from the Land dialogue those that are sourcing into an organic market or a lower input market or maybe selling into a farmer's market, a consumer-supported agricultural market. There's room for all of these systems. There is no silver bullet. And if we really do care about the environment, if we're concerned about biodiversity, if we're concerned about climate change, we can't dismiss the solution sets that modern-day commercial agriculture brings to the table. technological advances, biogenetic advances, like genetically modified crops.
Huh, that's a four-letter word to a lot of people.
It sure is. But what we are urging people to think about is, if we didn't have those tools, how would we be using the resource base? How much more land would we be turning over each year to produce crops? How much more encroachment into natural ecosystems would there be occurring? We're not saying that that's the model for every farm, ranch, and forest in the world. But in many places, it's an appropriate system that can produce environmental benefits, food security benefits, national security benefits, climate change benefits. And if you don't think holistically about all of the challenges that 9.5 billion people are going to bring to society, you can maybe miss that point.
I've been speaking with Ernie Shea, Project Coordinator of Solutions from the Land Dialogue. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Ed.
In tonight's forecast, across our listening area, tonight rain is likely with a chance of thunderstorms and lows should be in the 30s to mid-40s. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and highs in the 50s. And now for the editorial comments of Sterling Holy White Mountain.
In the background of all issues involving American Indians is always the question of what is an Indian. While there are any number of groups in this country today who have complicated issues surrounding identity, there is no identity issue more complicated than that of American Indian identity. As an aside, you will notice I did not say no identity issue is more important. It's difficult to call any American Indian issue in this country important in a standard social sense the way, say, African American issues are important. There simply aren't enough Indians in the country to warrant national media attention. A case in point is that of the most recent controversy surrounding the Washington football team's name. Notice that in all this talk, and there's a lot of talk, notice the only Indian that has made any kind of national public appearance anyone has paid attention to is the man team owner Dan Snyder trotted out to defend the name. And notice what is going on when so-called Chief Dodson is telling the nation that not only is the name okay with him, but that people in his community use the term regularly when greeting each other. Here we have an example of the inside being mistaken for the outside, and that age-old fallacy of one Indian's opinion being mistaken for that of every other Indian. The U.S. has a long history of mistaking one Indian for every Indian. All it takes is one look at the history of federal Indian policy to see this. For example, during the allotment era in the late 1800s, the idea was to civilize tribal members on reservations by turning them into farmers, even if the reservation where they were located was entirely unsuitable for farming. This policy, of course, was enacted by congressional members who had little to no experience with Indian country, but who nonetheless had near absolute power over tribes, a power that was finally solidified with the 1903 Lone Wolf v. Hitchcock U.S. Supreme Court ruling. What did the ruling say? That Congress had plenary power over tribes. What does plenary power mean? The Oxford English Dictionary defines plenary as such: full, complete, or perfect, not deficient in any element or respect, absolute. The Lone Wolf case, even though it was a case regarding the allotment of a single tribe's lands on the southern plains, gave Congress total and final power over all tribal affairs, placing tribes under a kind of political sword of Damocles, and along with it, the unending threat of congressional action without tribal consent. Consider the ideas of blood and blood quantum, the ideas we use today in large part to define who is and who is not an American Indian. These ideas do not have tribal origins. They originate in Europe hundreds of years before contact in North America. As early as the 1200s, the British were using the ideas of blood to limit political and social rights of people who were deemed less than so-called full blood. And they carried that idea to the New Continent, where they began implementing ideas of blood to penalize people who were married to either an Indian or an African American, and to limit a person's ability to testify in court or vote according to whether or not they were considered to be of so-called mixed blood. Tribes on this continent traditionally identified membership most simply by who was or was not living with and participating in the community. That is, if you live with the people, you are part of the people. These ideas of blood eventually extended to limiting the land ownership rights of Indians on reservations during the allotment era to such a degree that in some cases over 2/3 of a tribe was not allotted land on their respective reservations because they didn't meet so-called blood quantum criteria. A U.S.-established criteria, of course, that made it much easier to justify selling land that was left over to non-Indians, thus splitting up land ownership on reservations between tribal members and non-Indians. So how is it that I got to talking about blood? Because one of Snyder's contentions for the validity of Chief Dodson's opinion was that he is a full-blooded Inuit chief. The suggestion, of course, is that blood alone makes you an Indian. Never mind particular cultural knowledge, and definitely never mind speaking an indigenous language. The only thing that matters here is blood. This idea of Indian blood is so prevalent that any number of intelligent contemporary Americans have taken this idea of Indian blood at face value, as if there is some intrinsic value in the blood itself. But when we turn this idea around, things fall apart pretty fast. Because while there are plenty of people in Montana with so-called Irish blood, how much knowledge of Irish culture has this blood brought with it? If this blood thing isn't making much sense to you at this point, don't worry. You're not alone. It's never made any sense to me either. Finally, to return to a point I made earlier about so-called Chief Dodson's statement regarding Indians' use of the team's name as a kind of friendly greeting. I have never once seen it happen in my life. While the term skin is not uncommon among Indians who are friends, the point is that it's a term used by insiders among each other. In other words, I would love for Dan Snyder to walk into any social gathering place on any reservation or reserve in North America and say, "What's up, Redskins? I'm absolutely positive things would turn out just fine." I'm Sterling Holywhite Mountain. Thanks for listening.
Sterling Holywhite Mountain is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. Views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.